I am only in the mild preliminary stages yet. While waiting for the next move, make no mistake, when the real work begins, Wall Street and the system will look like last year's straw hat in the swirls of Niagara. If at Liberty, I could publish 10 lines, and a market break would be a reality. So sensational will be the smash. Believe me, it will carry the entire nation into panic.
That's Thomas Lawson, the nation's most feared stock advisor, financial reformer, and novelist, writing in 1905. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
During the economic depression of the 1890s and the speculative frenzy of the following decade, Americans were fascinated by the workings of Wall Street, high finance, and market crises. The topic of financial panic became a popular subject of novels. How do novels like Black Friday, The Pit, Friday the 13th, The Money Changers, and The Financier portray investment panic, financial games, and crowd psychology? Why was Thomas Lawson called both a financial terrorist and a financial messiah for using his financial exposés and novel to try to incite a cataclysmic financial panic? Our guest today for a show on panic in literature is David Zimmerman, professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of Panic, Markets, Crises, and Crowds in American Fiction, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2006.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
It's panic to look forward to. But from the description there that Emily gave us, talking about manipulation and mass psychology and Wall Street, I'm not sure if we're talking about 1906 or 2006. Some things don't seem to change that much.
It's true that it was a time where there was a widespread concern about corporate scandals and about the stock market going out of whack. And there was a concern at that time where the stock market was unfamiliar to many people. So it was partly the confusion about economic swings and about the role people play in those swings.
It seems like a funny juxtaposition in some way to have literature and then financial markets and Wall Street, because we don't think of Wall Street as particularly literary.
Right. Many people, their eyes glaze over when we talk about finance. And I have to say, before I wrote the book, I had no background in finance. And like some others in the humanities, I thought finance was dull. But then coming across this literature, one realizes, it's not hard to see, why markets are so exciting. They feature riveting suspense. Markets feature twists and climaxes, extraordinary personal drama, the anarchy of chance and crowds. And so writers found ample drama in the swings of the stock market and commodities exchanges.
Well, there have been panics, of course, before 100 years ago at 1837 and 1873 and
1857 as well.
93, yeah. So I suppose the closer you look, the more you'll find what was it in particular about this era 100 years ago at the turn of the 20th century that suddenly made novelists want to write about it.
Well, you're right. There had been fiction boomlets about panic after each of the previous panics. What was different about this era was that the American economy was being restructured around the corporation. And there was a sense of apocalypse at hand, where in the space of 6 years, 10 years, the American economy changed from firms competing against each other to corporations, many people thought, overtaking the economy, the massification of the economy. And panics played a central role in this overturning of the economy, because what business leaders realized after the panic of 1893 is that they had to restructure the economy, that it wasn't working, that it was anarchic. And so panic fiction develops in this space, a vortex, a kind of vertigo, where people weren't sure where history and where the economy was heading.
And what were these panic novels espousing, if anything?
Well, not all panic novels were political, but the authors came from various different political persuasions. I group them into three groups. There were the populists, who wanted to reverse this industrial juggernaut. They wanted to turn back time and replace the corporation with the earlier form of economy. And they saw panics as the handiwork of malevolent bankers, malevolent corporate titans. Socialists, on the other hand, actually saw the corporation as part of the evolving economy, and they saw it, they saw revolution at hand that would replace the corporation. And pro-capitalist novelists saw the corporation as a salvation for the nation, and they saw business leaders as progressive, enlightened ministers of this stability.
Despite the panics?
They saw corporations as a way of ending panics. They saw them directly as a way of ending panics.
Now, most of the novelists that you feature in your book are not ones that are household words. And, you know, the titles that we listed, like The Pit or Black Friday or, you know, Friday the 13th, those are not novels that we read widely today. They seem topical, in other words. Can you give us an example of a novel that was maybe the one that you use in your first chapter, this Frederick Isham's Black Friday? Is it something that only had a limited run and no longer was interesting after the time period in which it was written?
Right, yeah. That's exactly right with Black Friday. And in fact, with many of these panic novels, many of these panic novels are terrible novels, but terribly interesting. And they had this sort of currency of maybe blogs today, or radio talk shows where...
Careful.
Where politically polemical radio talk shows, fair point, where they had, some of them had a very clear agenda, but lost their topicality fairly soon after a certain political issue or a certain financial issue was decided upon, say, in Congress. Others have lasting power, like Frank Norris's The Pit. It's a book that's widely taught now, or Theodore Dreiser's The Financier. And those are very different kinds of novels, but they have lasting power.
It's almost as if these are sort of second string titles of first-rate American writers. I mean, you mentioned Dreiser and Norris. In other words, not their best-known works for some reason. And I'm wondering about one author who's not on there, which is to say Jack London. I'm surprised he wouldn't have had something to say about this, as he was interested in, you know, socialism and certainly wrote several novels along those lines.
Yeah, you know, he enters my book, but I don't focus on him, partly because so many writers wrote obliquely about finance or about financial panic. And I was most interested in novels that literally focused, their plots focused on Wall Street or the stock exchange or a market panic or... Chicago Board of Trade, something like that. Jack London, you know, his novel The Iron Heel, which is about a failed and ultimately successful socialist revolution that triggered by a Wall Street panic and featuring hordes of the underclass teeming into New York streets, and then they become corpses over which the capitalist tanks ride. So he enters the book and, you know, he offers one of the most sensational prophecies for what will happen if the capitalist steam engine is allowed to go forward.
Well, let's look at the one that you said was terrible but terribly interesting, Black Friday. Of those three groups, how does Frederick Isham fit in, and what is the plot of Black Friday?
You know, Isham is interesting because he's a pro-corporate novelist. He saw the corporation as a means of ending the anarchy that, to him, characterized the economy of the 1890s and earlier. And he saw that through centralization and rationalizing the economy, that the corporation could steady the American economy and, in fact, steady the American future and eliminate panics. And what makes his book terrible but terribly interesting is that he links panics with all kinds of other cultural disorders. So he links economic panic and cultural panic. So his book aims to equate financial panic with things like feminism, free love, and most alarming of all, the Paris Commune, a French Revolution. There's basically three plots of the novel. It features a financial titan who's the hero of the novel, and it's set in 1869 when there's a famous gold market panic called Black Friday, where Jay Gould tried to corner the nation's gold market. And it created a sensational panic, one of the most dramatic panics in American history. And this is the feature panic of the novel. And the Titan helps the president end this panic. The other plot line is he goes to Paris 2 years later, and he's thrust in the middle of the Paris Commune, this bloody, chaotic revolution. And a third plot line is a romance plot, like in so many of these finance novels, arcs through the entire novel.
I need to ask you how feminism comes in as a panic.
Yeah, Isham's book becomes interesting because it offers one of the most sweeping judgments of American cultural decline. In fact, it uses financial panic partly to make an economic argument about the virtues of the corporation and the stabilizing influence of the corporation, but partly to render this sweeping judgment about what is ruining America and what is basically causing America to spin out of control. And there he identifies sexual revolutionaries, Victoria Woodhull, Susan B. Anthony, who enter the book. They have cameo appearances in the novel. And the main woman character of the novel, insofar as she embraces these feminist ideals, is aligned fairly overtly with these feminists and revolutionaries from the 1870s, a couple generations earlier.
So these are symptoms of what is the same phenomenon that brings out the financial panic? In other words, these are negative
Absolutely.
Things to
It couldn't
address.
Be more alarming. There's a passage I can read
yes,
about,
please.
Yeah, about the feminism. And what's interesting about the feminists in particular who enter the novel and who are covertly behind the female character is it's not simply that their feminism offers an analogy with panic. The specific feminists that he talks about, Victoria Woodhull, Susan B. Anthony, also wrote about economics and also were aligned with class and working class and socialist revolution. So
from a capitalist standpoint, this is all
it was this
a
huge
negative.
It was a nightmare. Absolutely. They were aligned with nightmare. This is a scene from the last part of Black Friday where the hero finds himself in Paris and in the middle of the Paris Commune, this bloody revolt. We don't have a sense from this book of why there's this revolt. There's nothing rational about it. There's nothing really to explain it. But the image that we get is of feminists unleashing their fury upon Paris and putting it in flames. And the most famous characters, and this described the American press's account of the Paris Commune after 1871 when it occurred, was the female fire starter, the pétroleuse, the arsonists, the female arsonists who haunted Paris during the Paris Commune and set all of its cultural treasures on flame. So the character finds himself, this hero finds himself in Paris, and here's a scene where he encounters a panic in a theater and he encounters the pétroleuse. And this echoes a scene earlier of a financial panic in New York. The theater is on fire. The theater! A puff of smoke had curled outward from behind and arose like a thin veil. It was followed by a denser cloud. And on the instant, the romping dolls were stricken motionless like automatons that had run down. Merriment gave way to terror, laughter, to shrieks. Involuntarily, Richard Strong had stepped toward Dalton, a side character. When caught in the outward rush of the swaying throng, he was carried on as by a torrent, powerless to resist, held in that mighty whirl. His strength was as nothing to the aggregate force brought to bear upon him. In the narrow doorway, the jam became greater. A moment he realized the weight about him was crushing him into unconsciousness, and then suddenly he was shot forth against a wall. We have a couple more sentences, and then he sees shadows lurking on the streets of Paris. Suddenly they grew darker as from the sullen cauldrons where once monarchs had played at divine rites. Outpoured an increasing volume of smoke which now blotted from the sky, vivid hues. Only a sickly glow shot at intervals through the fumid mantle, making the shadows appear deeper, the streets more gloomy, and the people tristful specters that walked in darkness. But that they were not mere melancholy shadows, creatures passionless from the realms of night, was quickly made manifest to the man near the river. Les pétroleuses! The fire starters.
I like the use of that word automaton, too. That almost sounds like starts to sound like science fiction. It talks about these automatons that had wound down. What about the figure of the corporate executive in a novel like Black Friday? If corporations are going to be the salvation from all of this anarchy, how can you guarantee that the head of the corporation is going to be a benevolent dictator?
I'm not sure how
a philosopher king.
Yeah, I'm not sure how one can guarantee it, but in Isham's imagination and in the imaginations of pro-corporate novelists, that is how they characterize the business leaders. virtuous. They protected the nation, as you say, against anarchy. They protected it. They safeguarded it against betrayal. And they became the new founding fathers of the nation, the founders of the new American economy.
What does he have to say about how they got to the corporate top, though? I mean, is this just a Horatio Alger story for these corporate leaders rather than, you know, stepping on the backs of the masses?
You know, some authors clearly portray them as stepping on the backs of the masses. But others, writers like Frederick Isham, see them as hardworking, as seeing the future more ably than other people are able to. They seize the chance. So through hard work, through their keen intelligence, they are able to rise to the top. And it's not so much that they're rising to the top through a bureaucracy. They're creating the corporation. They're creating the railroad out of nothing. So they are creators. They, in some ways, are artist figures through their creation of these businesses.
And what was the readership like for Black Friday? Who was he writing it for? For businessmen? I mean, was this underwritten by corporations?
One of those how-to books?
You might think, no, I haven't found any evidence of that. You know, he was a Detroit newspaper man. I know that. This book was later made into a film a couple times. I don't know who was reading it. It's hard to say. For many Panic novels, it was clear that their readerships were already self-selected. You had populist writers writing for populist audiences. And again, in that way, it might be like a radio show, it might be like a blog, where you know what you're in for when you're opening this book. And the only case where we know who the audience was of a book was Thomas Lawson, who actually included letters from his readers at the back of his book.
Endorsements, or what we call blurbs today, testimonials.
Yeah, there were different we can talk about the appendix of this book. It's a featured part of this book. It was, and I have excerpts from those as well, it featured endorsements. It featured weepy testimonials. It also featured critics. It also featured one reader who said that Thomas Lawson had lost him following Lawson's advice. He had lost his money. But he's a supporter.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're going to have to get to know Thomas Lawson when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
We're always interested in hearing what you think about our programming. Please write to us with your comments at Audience Services, Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Avenue, Madison 53706.
Dear Sir, it has afforded me great pleasure to have just finished your first installment to Friday the 13th, as have also your previous writings, from which I learned a great deal. Although from a financial standpoint, following what I thought to be your advice, I'm several thousand dollars poorer, and I take this means of contributing my tiny bit of encouragement, firmly believing that your work is doing a great good and trusting that success on the lines you have mapped out will be your reward.
That's an Illinois reader writing to novelist and stock advisor Thomas Lawson in 1906. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is David Zimmerman, author of Panic, Markets, Crises, and Crowds in American Fiction. And we're talking about turn-of-the-century novels dealing with financial panic, including this strange figure that I'd never heard of, Thomas Lawson. Now, it's very interesting that reader is praising him even though he's lost money.
Well, Lawson, above all, was a contradictory figure. Nobody knew what to make of him. He exposed financial swindles. He gained a huge following, attacking corporations, attacking corporate scandals. And yet he was, by all accounts, a ruthless stock manipulator. And in fact, he began using his financial exposés to recruit a stock market army who, on his command, he thought and he hoped would create a cataclysmic financial panic. So nobody knew what to make of him, whether he was sincere in trying to reform and purge the U.S. financial system, whether he was simply out for his own money, and there's ample evidence for that, that he profited from every panic that he created. He was an acknowledged stock swindler. In fact, he oversaw the largest stock swindle to that time in American history, and his financial expose was partly an expose of the role he played in that. So he was this fantastically paradoxical, contradictory and sensational figure.
Well, what is he saying about the American financial market?
He says different things. His main target is Standard Oil. And he said that Standard Oil had gotten control of the insurance companies, gotten control of U.S. banking system, and with the money of U.S. depositors was rigging the stock market and creating panics at will.
Did Teddy Roosevelt read this book?
Everybody read this book. Major American novelist read this book. Teddy Roosevelt read this book. And Roosevelt thought that nobody would be fooled by Thomas Lawson. When Roosevelt gave his famous speech about the muckrakers, the journalists who were exposing the underside of America, and he was chastising those. He had Lawson directly in mind. He gave a speech to Congress where he talked about how Congress was so Lawsonized that they couldn't get any work done, that they were so frenzied by his alarms and so agitated and so incited.
Did Lawson come out of Chicago or a particular region of the country?
He settled in Boston. He made his early career, his claim to fame as a Boston copper stock promoter. And he made a name for himself by paying $30,000 to name a carnation after his wife when one could name a carnation.
A whole variety. We hope not just one flower.
A whole variety, one type.
Now that's an interesting mixture of sentiment and money.
Ostentatiousness, perhaps.
There was. Well, he didn't grow up with wealth, and he wanted to enter the upper classes. He was snubbed by the Boston high society set. And he, above all, he was a master of publicity, like P.T. Barnum, brass band and hurrah work, where he became a financial promoter and a financial destroyer. And as a financial promoter, he would do anything to promote a certain stock. And he actually created a town in Kentucky from scratch in 1890 through his newsletters, his advertisements. He had advertisements on butcher paper. And he said that this new town would rival Pittsburgh, and it never, in fact, emerged. He made equal name as a financial destroyer, where he would ruin rival promoters by putting effigies of rival promoters on carriages and parade them through Boston, making them look ridiculous. And he was among the most hated men in America, and several authors publicly threatened to shoot him. There was a famous duel after one panic that he caused. He was the subject of two novels, one admiring novel.
Well, he sounds like a character in a novel that you couldn't dream up.
He was, yeah. He becomes the main character of David Graham Phillips's novel from 1906, The Deluge.
And you said somebody called him the Moses of Destruction?
He had these various careers. On the one hand, he was the stock manipulator. He was also this financial journalist, this financial muckraker. And his exposés, according to many of his critics, were undermining the insurance business, were undermining the American economy. But he became most sensational when he came to believe that the only way to purge the U.S. financial system of the influence of evil Standard Oil barons was by creating a cataclysmic panic. And that's where he got this name as a Moses of Destruction.
Isn't there something a little contradictory in that, though, if somebody says ahead of time, I'm going to create a panic, doesn't that, by its very nature, tend to defuse and expose what he's up to?
You know, not in his case. Stock promoters and stock manipulators had always manipulated the market, but they'd always done so covertly. He is the first one to announce that he would cause a panic and do it.
Uh-huh.
And it was on the strength of his writing and on the strength of his following, where he had advertisements. He had a publicity machine. He would spend up to $90,000 a day telegraphing announcements. He had thousands of people reading his advertisements. And he claimed at the height of his power to have hundreds of thousands of followers. So his word went. What's so interesting about the stock market is that your words, or perhaps even your silence, can set off a market reaction. And at some point, if a critical mass even think that you're going to do something, it triggers a reaction that then snowballs. So by saying there was going to be a panic, he produced panics.
Well, we still see some of that effect today, too. Well, what about this novel of his in Friday the 13th? Is that just a big publicity vehicle of some kind that Lawson wrote?
And why did he write a novel? I mean, why not just stick to
butcher
paper? Right. I mean, what made him think, oh, I'll write a novel? That's a sort of indirect way, isn't it?
You know, it's interesting because his financial expose, Frenzied Finance, was a bestseller for 2 years, this 20-month run. And you would think that would do enough. It was so sensational, the claims it laid out. Crowds fought at newsstands. It was published in Everybody's Magazine. And on the strength of the expose and on the strength of the writing, it became the nation's bestselling. It quadrupled its circulation almost overnight once he started writing for it. Then he turned to the idea that the only way to reform wasn't simply by persuading people, was actually by creating a panic. And so now we enter the novel. And one reason he wanted to write the novel was he thought it would be more agitating than any of his exposés, particularly because it would arouse his audience's sympathies and his audience's sentiment. It's this book filled with weepy scenes where I can read some with grief, the story.
What are these ruined families that we're seeing?
Yeah, basically the story is of a stockbroker, a virtuous young guy named Bob Brownlee, who a young woman comes into his office, says that her family finances are in disorder. Can he basically put them in order through his stock brokerage? He says yes. He tries to do this, but it backfires. And it backfires because he learns that he's up against a villainous conspiracy of capitalists who are able to create panics at will. He feels so bad for this woman with whom now he's fallen in love.
Of course.
Of course. That he decides to learn what the system's trick is for creating panics. And he learns the trick. And the trick is basically that by opening his mouth and by saying that there will be a panic, he can create a panic. Slightly more complicated than that. And so the whole middle part of the book is he becomes the world's most powerful man and he can create destruction whenever he wants. He can send the world collapsing. What happens, however, is that when he creates his first cataclysmic panic, his love breaks down when she reads about the devastation that he's created. It coincides with the death of her own family. And so the rest of the book is his effort to avenge her breakdown and avenge what the system has done to her by taking vengeance on the system and ultimately purifying.
I think we need to hear a sample from Lawson's Friday the 13th.
The book is filled with these over-the-top scenes of financial devastation and lots of scenes on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and long speeches, but it's also filled with these maudlin sentimental scenes like the one that's following where Bob, the character, finds Beulah broken down at home, paralyzed, childlike. Bob was kneeling at the side of her chair, his hands clasped and uplifted in an agony of appeal that was supplemented by the awful groans. His face showed unspeakable terror and entreaty. The eyes were bursting from their sockets and were riveted on hers as those of a man in a dungeon might be fixed upon an approaching specter of whom he had murdered. Beulah Sands was a dead woman, not dead in body but in soul. There still resounded through the room the awful guttural groans. Beulah Sands smiled, the smile of an infant in the cradle. She took one beautiful hand from the paper and passed it over Bob's bronzed cheek, just as the infant touches its mother's face with its chubby fingers.
sounds like a bad imitation of Charles Dickens, too.
Well,
as if you take Dickens and, you know, with the pathos and everything. But
at the same time, I can almost see the screen flickering and hear the theater piano tinkling away to this kind of thing.
You can, but what's so remarkable and what's so crazy about this book is that it's that very emotionality. And the narrator who's telling the story is weeping as he's reporting this. And, you know, something like the lesson from this passage seems fairly clear in the novel, which is that in order to bring her back to normal, he has to bring the market back to normal. She's been orphaned. The market has been orphaned. And so the sentiment and the emotionality actually licenses the destruction that he's about to mete out in the stock market.
Now, how is he going to improve the market if he's just another one of these guys who knows the secret of triggering panic? So he can, it's one thing to bring the destruction of what, Standard Oil or something like that. but it's another to come up with an alternative system.
Yeah, what happens at the end of the book, again, fairly crazy, is that he threatens worldwide destruction.
And economic destruction?
Economic destruction through his market activities. And then he says, at a certain appointed hour, he's going to give a speech where he discloses the secret of how he does it. And he does. And he gives a speech. The world stops. Everybody tunes in, basically. Thousands of people crowding around the New York Stock Exchange and all of the brokers on the floor of the Stock Exchange. You can hear a pin drop. And he gives the speech outlining how he did it. And the speech then gives Americans a choice. They can deploy this technique and ruin each other and bring down the U.S. financial system, or they can regulate themselves. And so that's ultimately the choice that the book gives us at the end, regulate or be ruined.
Regulation, does he mean none of these Standard Oil, vertical monopoly things, or what does he mean?
In this case, he means certain ways of buying and selling stocks, certain kinds of short selling, certain kinds of financial shortcuts, certain kinds of financial mischief and deceit that would be outlawed.
Does he challenge at all the system itself? And, in other words, is this a book that gets at the fact that we need to approach each other with more charity and give away money? And, I mean, is it at all an attack on capitalism itself?
No. And one of the paradoxes of Lawson is that he was a capitalist through and through. Despite being a financial reformer, he wanted to reform capitalism, not do away with it. He wanted to purify financial markets, not do away with them. Ultimately, he became so frustrated with the American people in the panic of 1907 when they embraced J.P. Morgan and J.P. Morgan's rescue of America after that panic, that he returned to stock manipulation and returned to being a rogue capitalist, saying that he owed the public nothing. So on the one hand, he was a capitalist through and through. On the other hand, clearly he saw the market as this sentimental arena, an arena where people had feelings, and he tried to create this stock market army, an army of small investors who would feel the same sort of feelings that his characters feel, and that they would be linked through their grief and through their sympathy for his characters, and also, curiously, for Lawson himself. His wife died in 1905 or 1906. That death made front page of the New York Times. And I read that he continued, that his mourning was public news, where he continued to set the table for her even after she had died. He continued to drive to the train station to pick her up even though she had died. Apparently, he refused to let her body be buried. So the gothic extremes of his grief, his readers knew about this. And so partly what linked them as a stock market army, not only their sympathy for the characters, but their sympathy for Lawson himself. So he was a capitalist, but he did see the market itself as a sphere of charity, a sphere of mutual emotions. But then what makes it even more paradoxical is that he was embraced by the socialist press, who did want to upend capitalism, and they saw him as useful for the coming revolution.
Now, you said that he has an appendix in his book where he included reviewers and critics and readers. Can you give us another sample of the kinds of things that people were saying?
Sure. Part of my evidence for my claim that he was using emotion to build an army of followers actually is this appendix. I was wondering why he included this appendix where so many, and these appendix are these facsimiled, handwritten letters, handwriting, some of them are typed, from people from all over the nation saying how much they like the book, how they feel for the characters, and they are drenched in emotion. Dear Mr. Lawson, I've but just read the first installment of your serial, Friday the 13th. I was so interested, aroused, and stirred. I felt I must express to you some of the appreciation I feel for the work you have done and are doing. The army of those who suffer is so great, the human spoilers so strong, that our heart goes out in gratitude to a champion who comes armed and willing to do battle for the oppressed. One example. Another one from a woman in Kings County, California. I wanted to thank you for the first number of Friday the 13th. I live in the wildest of the Woolly West, and such a godsend is the magazine. Friday the 13th made an impression on me which I could not easily shake off. I was sorry it ended when it did. I wanted to cry out and could hardly wait for the January number. Yesterday I bought one in Stanford, California. I rode 30 miles to get it. You are Bob Brownlee, I know. Can you really feel what you write as you make us do? Your characters appeal to me so that I can live with them, every nerve alert to the straining point. You are certainly the idol of the American people. I'm glad you believe in sentiment, the heart, which I feared was becoming a thing of the past. There are still splendid men in America. God bless them. A happy new year. May the sweep of your pen sway millions. Amen.
Wow.
Oh boy.
It's certainly no more overwritten than some of the passages that you've read from his book. I guess they're cut from the same cloth. It is clearly a capitalist orientation, but emphasis on human values being somehow preserved in the capitalist system.
He believed in open markets and free markets, and he believed in the equation of free markets and democracy. So I think that's absolutely right, that he thought he could preserve these values by preserving the health of the markets.
But he didn't actually succeed in creating financial panic?
Oh, no, he did.
Oh, he
and
did? He,
absolutely. What launched his panic campaign and what convinced him that he would be able to pull it off and what convinced Americans for 2 years that he could pull off a cataclysmic panic was something that now is goes down in history is called the Lawson Panic in December 1904, where he put out some ads saying that people should buy stock in Amalgamated Copper. And people did. And then suddenly one day he reversed himself, saying, sell these. I've learned about some things that you should know about that make these worthless. And sell. I have lines from some of the telegrams that he sent around the market. So for 2 days, he flooded the papers with these feverish warnings. Every holder of Amalgamated owes it to himself to sell his holdings at once. In the next few days, there must be a terrific break. Sell steel, sell sugar, sell Southern Pacific, sell Union Pacific, Atchison, sell all the pool stocks. It would take 100 Morgans, 12 Standard Oils, and a few Banks of England to take what will be sold this trip. And 2 days later, frenzied by his alarms, the market crashed. He continued his threats, and over 3 days, almost $500 million of value in stocks disappeared. It was a panic that came seemingly out of the blue. Some tried to find other causes of it, but the New York Times, who is no friend of Lawson's, recognized that here was a man who announced a panic, who created a panic, and on the strength of his words alone and on the strength of his following, created a panic.
And we assume created some scenes just like the one in his book there of, you know, family demise.
Well, that was
despair.
It. He claimed to be protecting middle-class investors, middle-class consumers, but his critics feasted on his own explanations because, of course, these investors were also ruined in many cases by his panics. And he was contradictory, too, because he claimed that he was always acting in the interests of the American people. But he also admitted lying to them, but only in their interest. Or making false promises, but only in their interest.
Do you see him as power hungry? I mean, was this simply a way to show how powerful he was, partly?
You know, it's hard to tell. Clearly, there was a megalomaniac dimension to him. And there were several published diagnoses of his megalomania by psychiatrists who were called in to offer a clinical diagnosis of him. Some said he was clinically insane. Some said he was simply despised. Ministers preached sermons against him. He was a front page figure for several years where the New York Times and other newspapers railed against him.
What became of Thomas Lawson?
You know, at the height of his influence, he was named as possible gubernatorial candidate in Massachusetts, named as a possible presidential candidate. But he returns to stock manipulation in 1907, disgusted with the American people. After that, we don't know. He continues to publish some things. I'm less familiar with what happens to him after that, except that he dies in 1925 apparently under a cloud of scandal about false advertising and stock manipulation.
It was a good decade.
His grandson becomes governor of Oregon, and he retreats to a house that still exists in Scituate, Massachusetts, his mansion there.
And no other novel, just Friday the 13th.
Just Friday the 13th.
We're going to explore more writers on the topic of financial panic, including Frank Norris and Upton Sinclair, when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Now you can listen to many WPR programs at your convenience when you visit WPR.org. Browse the archive of current and past programs. WPR.org is there to give you options.
There in the center of the nation, midmost of that continent that lay between the oceans of the New World and the Old, in the heart's heart of the affairs of men, roared and rumbled the pit. It was as if the wheat, nourisher of the nations, as it rolled gigantic and majestic in a vast flood from west to east, here like a Niagara, finding its flow impeded, burst suddenly into the appalling fury of the maelstrom, into the chaotic spasm of a world force, a primeval energy, blood brother of the earthquake and the glacier, raging and wrathful that its power should be braved by some pinch of human spawn that dared raise barriers across its courses.
Frank Norris, fascinated by and fascinating with The Pit, the name of his novel that has to do with Wall Street and financial panic. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, David Zimmerman, an expert on a fascinating corner of novelistic history, which is to say novels about financial panic, those particularly from just about 100 years ago. Frank Norris was known as one of those muckrakers that Teddy Roosevelt would have disapproved of. Is he talking politics, or is he more interested in psychology when he writes a novel like The Pit about panic?
Yeah, I think Norris's status as a muckraker is overstated. I don't think his ambitions were primarily muckraking or political in writing The Pit. I think he was most fascinated by psychology, by how the market incites and inspires certain forms of psychological activity, certain forms of psychological connection between individuals and between individuals and the market itself.
Well, that passage you read seemed to be loaded with nightmare imagery, hellish imagery. It's, again, very overblown.
I would – and that's signature Norris. Not so much nightmarish in my reading as he was fascinated with scenes of power, scenes of sort of sublime, overwhelming forces at work.
It seems like the key metaphor here, we've heard it twice now, is Niagara Falls.
Or Maelstrom,
yes,
that's right.
Unstoppable, mm-hmm. Just this huge unstoppable force.
Unstoppable, that's right.
Well, for me, that would be a nightmare. And in fact, the cover that you've got of your version of The Pit showing this crowd of people is a kind of nightmare vision where you're trampled by a crowd.
Here at Chicago, in the Chicago Board of Trade, the nation's wheat market. And so here, although there are nightmarish scenes later perhaps, here Norris is actually celebrating the natural forces at work.
Oh, that was a positive passage?
Of supply and demand from consumers to farmers. And at the center is how wheat is bought and sold, how the price of wheat is determined. If prices on the wheat exchange rise, more farmers plant their wheat.
Kind of reminds me of Sandburg talking about Chicago, you know,
right.
Hog
yeah.
Butcher of the world.
Absolutely.
And this kind of thing.
And this was, it was part of an epic trilogy that he wanted to write about the wheat trade and all different facets of the wheat trade. And so if he uses metaphors like Niagara or Maelstrom, it's because he sees the flow of wheat and the trade of wheat as registering natural laws, even divine laws, perhaps, at work.
Well, what is the purpose of the novel The Pit, then, and how does the plot proceed? I mean, is he writing it, again, to make a point about the financial system, or is he more just creating a good story?
He's doing a couple things. Again, I don't read this novel as being particularly political. It focuses on a wheat speculator who gets the idea that he can corner or monopolize the world's wheat, and through a system of covert financial purchases and manipulations, he is able briefly to do that. And in cornering the world's wheat, it means that nobody can purchase it. He owns it all, so he can sell it when he chooses to. And it means that he's starving people. And ultimately, Norris wants to show that one can't hold back nature. One can't contain the wheat. And so the corner breaks. And his enemies attack his campaign, and they win, and then he succumbs at the end.
Why do I expect him to have some image of somebody getting buried in a silo?
That's it, right? Yeah, just like in The Octopus, another book part of the trilogy. Here, the wheat literally strikes him in the face. Here is a moment where the wheat market takes its revenge and where nature, flowing dynamic nature, takes its revenge on somebody who would dare to dam it, to stop it from moving. The scene here is where one of the main characters, lieutenants, is trying to protect the wheat corner and is waiting for the trading to start on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade. Was the gong never going to strike? He found himself all at once out on the edge of the wheat pit. It was jammed tight with the crowd of traders and the excitement that disengaged itself from that tense, vehement crowd of white faces and glittering eyes was veritably sickening, veritably weakening. Men on either side of him were shouting mere incoherencies to which nobody, not even themselves, were listening. Others, silent, gnawed their nails to the quick, breathing rapidly, audibly even, their nostrils expanding and contracting. All around roared the vague thunder that since early morning had shaken the building. In the pit, the bids leaped to and fro, though the time of opening had not yet come. The very planks underfoot seemed spinning about in the first huge warning swirl of the pit's centripetal convulsion. There was dizziness in the air. Something, some infinite, immeasurable power, onrushing in its eternal courses, shook the pit in its grasp. Something deafened the ears, blinded the eyes, dulled and numbed the mind with its roar, with the chaff and dust of its whirlwind passage, with the stupefying sense of its power, coeval with the earthquake and glacier, merciless, all-powerful, a primal basic throw of creation itself, unassailable, inviolate, and untamed. The pit was mad, was drunk, and frenzied.
Wow.
A little over the top and yet kind of engaging, too.
It is over the top.
Now, Upton Sinclair we think of as a muckraker, as, you know, for his expose, The Jungle and other things. What about when he turns his attention to the stock market?
You know, there a panic struck United States in 1907, where one of New York's largest banks mysteriously couldn't meet its obligations, and that triggered a panic. And the socialist press saw this as a teachable moment. So this was the moment they'd long been awaiting for. There had been predictions of a coming revolution. They saw the moment at hand, and special panic of the editions urged socialist writers to put literature into Americans' hands that would explain and educate and incite the revolution. Upton Sinclair rushed to the task because he wrote a novel directly about the Panic of 1907. And he was friends with a lawyer who had visited the banker of this ruined bank who killed himself soon after the panic started. And Upton Sinclair wrote a novel, a behind-the-scenes novel, explaining the causes of this panic.
And if we look at Money Changers, what is the plot?
The plot is of a virtuous, uncorruptible young lawyer in New York who learns bit by bit about how corrupt and how evil Wall Street is. And he learns, he comes across J.P. Morgan's plans to create a panic and shake down the Congress and shake down the American people. And ultimately, he becomes converted to a muckraker and to a politician. And he hopes to recruit, not like Thomas Lawson, a stock market army, but he wants to recruit people into, in effect, a political party or a platform that would counter the influence of rogue capitalists and bankers.
J.P. Morgan in particular named in the book.
By a different name, but it's there are very close parallels between the characters and actual figures. He said later that it would be obvious to anybody who is familiar with the history of the Panic who the characters were. It was a thinly veiled allegory. It's another terrible but terribly interesting book. He wrote it quickly, he said, and critics reading the book urged him not to write fiction again. That's how bad it was.
And as you look at some of these novels that we've been talking about, like Black Friday, Friday the 13th, The Pit, The Money Changers, what makes them, in your opinion, relevant today or interesting today?
Well, I think they first have historical interest. I think we can learn about the emergence of things that continue to interest us today. So panic fiction, I think, is a particularly interesting and useful lens through which we can see, for example, how modern understandings of economic crises and markets emerged. And we can also see how Americans struggled to understand economic crisis, economic jarring change, and in particular, how they linked economic change to other forms of cultural panic, other forms of cultural disorder. So there are a couple ways we can link it to events today. One, maybe not so strangely, is 9/11, where the writers that I write about saw themselves writing at a period of time when apocalypse, they thought, was at hand, where the future of the nation was uncertain because of this economic restructuring, where the threat of revolution to many people seemed imminent, a violent revolution seemed imminent, of bloodshed in the streets. And so in telling the story of financial panics, they were trying to help Americans understand a vision of the future, offer a roadmap to a safer future, or simply make it manageable, psychologically manageable in the stories they would tell. And in that way, I think it's similar to times now where here we are in America after 9/11, where the fate of the nation, the identity of the nation, the values of the nation, our relationship to other countries are being hotly debated, and we will see more and more fiction writers playing a role in helping us understand where we're at, where we're going. Another relevance today, back to Upton Sinclair, would be these books articulate a business morality, a notion of who is to blame, how we as shareholders, as readers, might be implicated in the economic practices of businesses. I think that would be very relevant today, especially as the economy expands, becomes more global. The cause of economic injury is sometimes obscure, and sometimes we don't know how we're connected to economic practices that we might object to, that we might see as unfair. And these novels help us envision an economy that in some ways is unenvisionable, that's too vast or too abstract or too chaotic in some cases, even to imagine. So they give us pictures to see how we are connected to these economic harms and these economic activities.
I would think that looking at these novels also would shed light on novels where it's more in the background, whether it's The Great Gatsby or something else.
Or Edith Wharton, sure.
Yeah, just where it's not the centerpiece, but it's still underlying the background there.
Oh, I absolutely think that's right. And one of the pleasures of these books is that it makes you more attuned to the presence, the shadowing presence of finance in so many books of American and other literatures as well, but especially in American literature.
David Zimmerman, thank you for sharing your insights into panic in literature for this hour of University of the Air.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, a road trip as we hear Trevor Stevenson playing a harpsichord, one of the very last in the line of the development of that instrument. It's next Sunday afternoon at 4. Join us right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.